some of the life had gone out of Father. She was always so calm, Catelyn thought, remembering her mother's soft hands, her warm smile. If she had lived, how different our lives might have been. She wondered what Lady Minnesa would make of her eldest daughter, kneeling here before her. I have come so many thousands of leagues, and for what? Who have I served? I've lost my daughters. Rob does not want me. And Bran and Rickon must surely think me a cold and unnatural mother. I was not even with Ned when he died. Her head swam and the sept seemed to move around her. The shadows swayed and shifted, furtive animals racing across the cracked white walls. Catelyn had not eaten today. Perhaps that had been unwise. She told herself that there had been no time. But the truth was that food had lost its savor in a world without Ned. When they took his head off, they killed me too. Behind her, the torch spit, and suddenly it seemed to her that it was her sister's face on the wall, though the eyes were harder than she recalled. Not Lysa's eyes, but Cersei's. Cersei is a mother too. No matter who fathered those children, she felt them kick inside her, brought them forth with her pain and blood, nursed them at her breast. If they are truly Jaime's, does Cersei pray to you too, my lady? Catelyn asked the mother. She could see the proud, cold, lovely features of the Lannister queen etched upon the wall. The crack was still there. Even Cersei could weep for her children. Each of the seven embodies all of the seven, Septon Osmond had told her once. There was as much beauty in the crone as in the maiden, and the mother could be fiercer than the warrior when her children were in danger. Yes. She had seen enough of Robert Baratheon at Winterfell to know that the king did not regard Joffrey with any great warmth. If the boy was truly Jaime's seed, Robert would have put him to death, along with his mother, and few would have condemned him. Bastards were common enough, but incest was a monstrous sin to both old gods and new, and the children of such wickedness were named abominations in Sept and Godswood alike. The Dragon Kings had wed brother to sister, but they were the blood of old Valyria, where such practices had been common. And like their dragons, the Targaryens answered to neither gods nor men. Ned must have known, and Lord Aeron before him. Small wonder that the queen had killed them both. Would I do any less for my own? Catelyn clenched her hands, feeling the tightness in her scarred fingers where the assassin's steel had cut to the bone as she fought to save her son. Bran knows too, she whispered, lowering her head. Gods be good. He must have seen something, heard something. That was why they had tried to kill him in his bed. Lost and weary, Catelyn Stark gave herself over to her gods. She knelt before the smith, who fixed things that were broken, and asked that he give her sweet Bran his protection. She went to the maid and beseeched her to lend her courage to Arya and Sansa, to guard them in their innocence. To the father she prayed for justice, the strength to seek it, and the wisdom to know it. And she asked the warrior to keep Rob strong and shield him in his battles. Lastly, she turned to the crone, whose statues often showed her with a lamp in one hand. Guide me, wise lady, she prayed. Show me the path I must walk, and do not let me stumble in the dark places that lie ahead. Finally, there were footsteps behind her, and a noise at the door. My lady, Sir Robar said gently, pardon, but our time is at an end. We must be back before the dawn breaks. Catelyn rose stiffly. Her knees ached, and she would have given much for a feather bed and a pillow just then. Thank you, sir. I am ready. They rode in silence through sparse woodland where the trees leaned drunkenly away from the sea. The nervous whinny of horses and the clank of steel guided them back to Renly's camp. The long ranks of man and horse were armored in darkness, as black as if the smith had hammered night itself into steel. There were banners to her right, banners to her left, and rank on rank of banners before her. But in the pre-dawn gloom, neither colors nor sigils could be discerned. A grey army, Catelyn thought. Grey men on grey horses beneath grey banners. As they sat their horses waiting, Renly's shadow knights pointed their lances upward, so she rode through a forest of tall, naked trees bereft of leaves and life. Where Storm's End stood was only a deeper darkness, a wall of black, through which no stars could shine. But she could see torches moving across the fields where Lord Stannis had made his camp. The candles within Renly's pavilion made the shimmering silken walls seem to glow, transforming the great tent into a magical castle alive with emerald light. Two of the Rainbow Guards stood sentry at the door to the royal pavilion. The green light shone strangely against the purple plums of Sir Parman's surcoat, and gave a sickly hue to the sunflowers that covered every inch of Sir Eamon's enameled yellow plate. Long silken plumes flew from their helms, and rainbow cloaks draped their shoulders. Within, Catelyn found Brienne armoring the king for battle, while the lords Tarly and Rowan spoke of dispositions and tactics. It was pleasantly warm inside, the heat shimmering off the coals of a dozen small braziers. "I must speak with you, Your Grace," she said, granting him a king's style for once, anything to make him heed her. "In a moment, Lady Catelyn," Renly replied. Brienne fit backplate to breastplate over his quilted tunic. The king's armour was a deep green, the green of leaves in a summer wood, so dark it drank the candlelight. Gold highlights gleamed from inlay and fastenings like distant fires in that wood, winking every time he moved. "Pray continue, Lord Mathis." "Your Grace," Mathis Rowan said, with a sideways glance at Catelyn, "as I was saying, our battles are well drawn up. Why wait for daybreak? Sound the advance. And have it said that I won by treachery, with an unchivalrous attack. Dawn was the chosen hour."
"Chosen by Stannis," Randall Tarly pointed out. "He'd have us charge into the teeth of the rising sun. We'll be half blind."
"Only until first shock," Renly said confidently. "Sir Loras will break them, and after that it will be chaos." Brienne tightened green leather straps and buckled golden buckles. "When my brother falls, see that no insult is done to his corpse. Is my own blood. I will not have his head paraded about on the spear."
"And if he yields?" Lord Tarly asked.
"Yields?" Lord Rowan laughed. "When Mace Tyrell laid siege to Storm's End, Stannis ate rats rather than open his gates."
"Well, I remember." Renly lifted his chin to allow Brienne to fasten his gorget in place.
"Near the end, Sir Gawain Wild and three of his knights tried to steal out of a postern gate to surrender. Stannis caught them and ordered them flung from the walls with catapults. I can still see Gawain's face as they strapped him down. He'd been our master at arms." Lord Rowan appeared puzzled.
"No men were hurled from the walls. I surely remember that."
"Maester Cressin told Stannis that we might be forced to eat our dead, and there was no gain in flinging away good meat." Renly pushed back his hair. Brienne bound it with a velvet tie and pulled a padded cap down over his ears to cushion the weight of his helm. "Thanks to the Onion Knight, we were never reduced to dining on corpses, but it was a close thing. Too close for Sir Gawain, who died in his cell." "Your Grace," Catelyn had waited patiently, but time grew short. "You promised me a word." Renly nodded. "Siege your battles, my lords. Oh, and if Barristan Selmy is at my brother's side, I want him spared."
There's been no word of Sir Barristan since Joffrey cast him out," Lord Rowan objected.
"I know that old man. He needs a king to guard, or who is he? Yet he never came to me, and Lady Catelyn says he is not with Robb Stark at Riverrun. Where else but with Stannis?"
"As you say, your Grace, no harm will come to him."
The lords bowed deeply and departed. "Say your say, Lady Stark," Renly said. Brienne swept his cloak over his broad shoulders. It was cloth of gold, heavy, with a crown stag of Baratheon picked out in flakes of jet. "The Lannisters tried to kill my son, Bran. 1,000 times I have asked myself why. Your brother gave me my answer. There was a hunt the day he fell. Robert and Ned and most of the other men rode out after the boar, but Jaime Lannister remained at Winterfell, as did the Queen. Renly was not slow to take the implication. So, you believe the boy caught them at their incest? I beg you, my lord, grant me leave to go to your brother Stannis and tell him what I suspect. To what end? Rob will set aside the crown if you and your brother will do the same, she said, hoping it was true. She would make it true if she must. Rob would listen to her, even if his lords would not. Let the three of you call for a great council, such as the realm has not seen for 100 years. We will send to Winterfell, so Bran may tell his tale and all men may know the Lannisters for the true usurpers. Let the assembled lords of the Seven Kingdoms choose who shall rule them. Renly laughed. Tell me, my lady, do direwolves vote on who should lead the pack? Brienne brought the king's gauntlets and great helm, crowned with golden antlers that would add 1.5 feet to his height. The time for talk is done. Now we will see who is stronger. Renly pulled a lobstered green and gold gauntlet over his left hand, while Brienne knelt to buckle on his belt, heavy with the weight of a long sword and dagger. I beg you, in the name of the mother, Catelyn began when a sudden gust of wind flung open the door of the tent. She thought she glimpsed movement, but when she turned her head, it was only the king's shadow shifting against the silken walls. She heard Renly begin a jest, his shadow moving, lifting its sword, black on green, candles guttering, shivering. Something was queer, wrong. And then she saw Renly's sword still in its scabbard, sheathed still, but the shadow sword... Cold, said Renly, in a small, puzzled voice, a heartbeat before the steel of his gorget parted like cheesecloth beneath the shadow of a blade that was not there. He had time to make a small, thick gasp before the blood came gushing out of his throat. Your great... No! Cried Brienne the Blue, when she saw that evil flow, sounding as scared as any little girl. The king stumbled into her arms, a sheet of blood out of his armor, a dark red tide that drowned his green and gold. More candles guttered out. Renly tried to speak, but he was choking on his own blood. His legs collapsed, and only Brienne's strength held him up. She threw back her head and screamed, wordless, in her anguish. The shadow. Something dark and evil had happened here, she knew. Something that she could not begin to understand. Renly never cast that shadow. Death came in that door and blew the life out of him, as swift as the wind snuffed out his candles. Only a few instants passed before Robar Royce and Eamon Kai came bursting in, though it felt like half the night. A pair of men-at-arms crowded in behind with torches. When they saw Renly in Brienne's arms and her drenched with the king's blood, Sir Robar gave a cry of horror. "Wicked woman!" screamed Sir Eamon, he of the sun-flowered steel. "Away from him, you vile creature!" "Gods be good, Brienne, why?" asked Sir Robar. Brienne looked up from her king's body. The rainbow cloak that hung from her shoulders had turned red where the king's blood had soaked into the cloth.
I...
You'll die for this, Sir Eamon snatched up a long-handled battle-axe from the weapons pile near the door. You'll pay for the king's life with your own. No, Catelyn Stark screamed, finding her voice at last. But it was too late. The blood madness was on them, and they rushed forward with shouts that drowned her softer words. Brienne moved faster than Catelyn would have believed. Her own sword was not to hand, so she snatched Renly's from his scabbard and raised it to catch Eamon's axe on the dance wing. A spark flashed blue-white as steel met steel with a rending crash, and Brienne sprang to her feet, the body of the dead king thrust rudely aside. Sir Eamon stumbled over it as he tried to close, and Brienne's blade sheared through the wooden haft to send his axe-head spinning. Another man thrust a flaming torch at her back, but the rainbow cloak was too sudden with blood to burn. Brian spun and cut, and torch and hand went flying. Flames crept across the carpet. The maimed man began to scream. Sir Eamon dropped the axe and fumbled for his sword. The second man at arms lunged. Brian parried, and their swords danced and clanged against each other. When Eamon Kai came wading back in, Brian was forced to retreat, yet somehow she held them both at bay. On the ground, Renly's head rolled sickeningly to one side, and a second mouth yawned wide, the blood coming from him now in slow pulses. Sir Robar had hung back, uncertain, but now he was reaching for his hilt.
Robar, no, listen. Catelyn seized his arm. You do her wrong. It was not her. Help her. Hear me, it was Stannis.
The name was on her lips before she could think how it got there. But as she said it, she knew that it was true.
I swear it, you know me. It was Stannis killed him.
The young Rainbow Knight stared at this mad woman with pale and frightened eyes.
Stannis? How?
I do not know. Sorcery, some dark magic. There was a shadow, a shadow. Her own voice sounded wild and crazed to her, but the words poured out in a rush as the blaze continued to clash behind her.
A shadow with a sword, I swear it. I saw. Are you blind? The girl loved him. Help her.
She glanced back, saw the second guardsman fall, his blade dropping from limp fingers. Outside, there was shouting. More angry men would be bursting in on them any instant, she knew.
She is innocent, Robar. You have my word, on my husband's grave, and my honor as a Stark.
That resolved him.
I will hold them,
Sir Robar said.
Get her away.
He turned and went out. The fire had reached the wall and was creeping up the side of the tent. Sir Eamon was pressing Brian hard, him in his enameled yellow steel and her in wool. He had forgotten Catelyn until the iron brazier came crashing into the back of his head. Helmed as he was, the blow did no lasting harm, but it sent him to his knees.
Brian, with me,
Catelyn commanded. The girl was not slow to see the chance. A slash, and the green silk parted. They stepped out into darkness and the chill of dawn. Loud voices came from the other side of the pavilion.
This way, Catelyn urged, and slowly. We must not run, or they will ask why. Walk easy, as if nothing were amiss.
Brian thrust her sword blade through her belt and fell in beside Catelyn. The night air smelled of rain. Behind them, the king's pavilion was well ablaze, flames rising high against the dark. No one made any move to stop them. Men rushed past them, shouting of fire and murder and sorcery. Others stood in small groups and spoke in low voices. A few were praying, and one young squire was on his knees, sobbing openly. Renly's battles were already coming apart as the rumors spread from mouth to mouth. The night fires had burned low, and as the east began to lighten, the immense mass of Storm's End emerged like a dream of stone, while wisps of pale mist raced across the field, flying from the sun on wings of wind. Morning ghosts, she'd heard old Nan call them once, spirits returning to their graves. And Renly, one of them now, gone like his brother Robert, like her own dear Ned.
I never held him but as he died,
Brian said quietly as they walked through the spreading chaos. Her voice sounded as if she might break at any instant.
He was laughing one moment, and suddenly the blood was everywhere. My lady, I do not understand. Did you see? Did you?
I saw a shadow. I thought it was Renly's shadow at first, but it was his brother's.
Lord Stannis? I felt him. It makes no sense, I know.
It made sense enough for Brian.
I will kill him,
the tall, homely girl declared.
With my lord's own sword, I will kill him. I swear it. I swear it. I swear it.
Hal Mullen and the rest of her escort were waiting with the horses. Sir Wendell Manderley was all of a lather to know what was happening.
My lady, the camp has gone mad,
he blurted when he saw them.
Lord Renly is here.
He stopped suddenly, staring at Brian,
and the blood that drenched her. Dead, but not by our hands.
The battle,
Hal Mullen began. There will be no battle. Catelyn mounted, and her escort formed up about her, with Sir Wendell to her left and Sir Perrin Frey on her right. Bryeen, we brought Mansonoff for twice our number. Choose one and come with us.
I have my own horse, my lady, and my armor.
Leave them. We must be well away before they think to look for us. We were both with the king when he was killed. That will not be forgotten. Wordless, Bryeen turned and did as she was bid. Ride, Catelyn commanded her escort when they were all a horse. If any man tries to stop us, cut him down. As the long fingers of dawn fanned across the fields, color was returning to the world. Where gray men had sat gray horses armed with shadow spears, the points of 10,000 lances now glinted silverly cold, and on the myriad flapping banners, Catelyn saw the blush of red and pink and orange, the richness of blues and browns, the blaze of gold and yellow. All the power of Storm's End and High Garden, the power that had been Renly's an hour ago. They belong to Stannis now, she realized. Even if they do not know it themselves yet, where else are they to turn, if not to the last Baratheon? Stannis has won all with a single evil stroke. I am the rightful king, he had declared, his jaw clenched hard as iron. And your son, no less a traitor than my brother here, his day will come as well. A chill went through her. John. The hill, jutted above the dense tangle of forest, rising solitary and sudden, its windswept heights visible for miles off. The wildlings called it the Fist of the First Men, Rangers said. It did look like a fist, Jon Snow thought, punching up through the earth and wood, its bare brown slopes knuckled with stone. He rode to the top, with Lord Mormont and the officers, leaving Ghost below under the trees. The direwolf had run off three times as they climbed, twice returning reluctantly to John's whistle. The third time, the Lord Commander lost patience and snapped, Let him go, boy! I want to reach the crest before dusk. Find the wolf later! The way up was steep and stony, the summit crowned by a chest-high wall of tumbled rocks. They had to circle some distance west before they found a gap large enough to admit the horses. This is good ground, Thorin, the old bear proclaimed when at last they attained the top. We could scarce hope for better. We'll make our camp here to await Half Hand. The Lord Commander swung down off his saddle, dislodging the raven from his shoulder. Complaining loudly, the bird took to the air. The views atop the hill were bracing. Yet it was the ring wall that drew John's eye, the weathered grey stones with their white patches of lichen, their beards of green moss. It was said that the fist had been a ring fort of the first men in the Dawn Age. An old place and strong, Thorin Smallwood said.
Old!
Mormont's raven screamed as it flapped in noisy circles about their heads.
Old! Old! Old!
Quiet! Mormont growled at the bird. The old bear was too proud to admit to weakness, but John was not deceived. The strain of keeping up with younger men was taking its toll.
These heights will be easy to defend if need be, Thorin pointed out as he walked his horse along the ring of stones, his sable-trimmed cloak stirring in the wind.
Yes, this place will do.
The old bear lifted a hand to the wind, and Raven landed on his forearm, claws scrabbling against the black ringmail. What about water, my lord? John wondered.
We crossed a brook at the foot of the hill.
Long climb for a drink, John pointed out, and outside the ring of stones. Thorin said,
Are you too lazy to climb a hill, boy?
When Lord Mormont said,
We're not like to find another place as strong. We'll carry water and make certain we're well supplied.
John knew better than to argue. So the command was given, and the brothers of the Night's Watch raised their camp behind the stone ring the first men had made. Black tents sprouted like mushrooms after a rain, and blankets and bedrolls covered the bare ground. Stewards tethered the garrons in long lines and saw them fed and watered. Foresters took their axes to the trees in the waning afternoon light to harvest enough wood to see them through the night. A score of builders set to clearing brush, digging latrines, and untying their bundles of fire-hardened stakes.
"I will have every opening in the ring wall ditched and staked before dark," the old bear had commanded.
Once he'd put up the Lord Commander's tent and seen to their horses, Jon Snow descended the hill in search of Ghost. The direwolf came at once, all in silence. One moment, Jon was striding beneath the trees, whistling and shouting, alone in the green, pine cones and fallen leaves under his feet. The next, the great white direwolf was walking beside him, pale as morning mist. But when they reached the ring fort, Ghost balked again. He padded forward wearily to sniff at the gap in the stones, and then retreated, as if he did not like what he smelled. Jon tried to grab him by the scruff of his neck and haul him bodily inside the ring. No easy task. The wolf weighed as much as he did, and was stronger by far.
"Ghost, what's wrong with you?"
It was not like him to be so unsettled. In the end, Jon had to give it up. "As you will," he told the wolf. "Go hunt." The red eyes watched him as he made his way back through the mossy stones. They ought to be safe here. The hill offered commanding views, and the slopes were precipitous to the north and west and only slightly more gentle to the east. Yet as the dawn deepened and darkness seeped into the hollows between the trees, John's sense of foreboding grew.
"This is the haunted forest," he told himself. "Maybe there are ghosts here, the spirits of the first men. This was their place once." "Stop acting the boy," he told himself.
Clambering atop the piled rocks, Jon gazed off toward the setting sun. He could see the light shimmering like hammered gold off the surface of the milk water as it curved away to the south. Upriver, the land was more rugged, the dense forest giving way to a series of bare, stony hills that rose high and wild to the north and west. On the horizon stood the mountains, like a great shadow, range on range of them, receding into the blue-gray distance, their jagged peaks sheathed eternally in snow. Even from afar, they looked vast and cold and inhospitable. Closer at hand, it was the trees that ruled. To south and east, the wood went on as far as Jon could see, a vast tangle of root and limb painted in a thousand shades of green, with here and there a patch of red where a weirwood shouldered through the pines and sentinels, or a blush of yellow where some broadleaves had begun to turn. When the wind blew, he could hear the creak and groan of branches older than he was. A thousand leaves fluttered, and for a moment the forest seemed a deep green sea, storm-tossed and heaving, eternal and unknowable. Ghost was not like to be alone down there, he thought. Anything could be moving under that sea, creeping toward the ring fort through the dark of the wood, concealed beneath those trees. Anything. How would they ever know? He stood there for a long time, until the sun vanished behind the saw-toothed mountains and darkness began to creep through the forest.
"John," Samuel Tarly called up. "I thought it looked like you. Are you well?"
"Well enough," John hopped down. "How did you fare today?"
"Well, I fared well, truly."
John was not about to share his disquiet with his friend, not when Samuel Tarly was at last beginning to find his courage. "The old bear means to wait here for Corin Halfhand and the men from the Shadow Tower."
"It seems a strong place," said Sam. "A ring fort of the first men. Do you think there were battles fought here?"
"No doubt. You'd best get a bird ready. Mormont will want to send back word."
"I wish I could send them all. They hate being caged."
"You would too, if you could fly."
"If I could fly, I'd be back at Castle Black eating a port pie," said Sam.
John clapped him on the shoulder with his burned hand. They walked back through the camp together. Cook fires were being lit all around them. Overhead, the stars were coming out. The long red tail of Mormont's torch burned as bright as the moon. John heard the ravens before he saw them. Some were calling his name. The birds were not shy when it came to making noise. They feel it too. I'd best see to the old bear, he said. He gets noisy when he isn't fed as well. He found Mormont talking with Thorin Smallwood and half a dozen other officers. There you are, the old man said gruffly. Bring us some hot wine, if you would. The night is chilly. Yes, my lord. John built a cook fire, claimed a small cask of Mormont's favorite robust bread from stores, and poured it into a kettle. He hung the kettle above the flames while he gathered the rest of his ingredients. The old bear was particular about his hot spiced wine. So much cinnamon, and so much nutmeg, and so much honey, not a drop more. Raisins and nuts and dried berries, but no lemon. That was the rankest sort of southern heresy, which was queer, since he always took lemon in his morning beer. The drink must be hot, to warm a man properly, the Lord Commander insisted, but the wine must never be allowed to come to a boil. John kept a careful eye on the kettle. As he worked, he could hear the voices from inside the tent. Jarman Buckle said, The easiest road up into the Frostfangs is to follow the Miltwater back to its source. Yet if we go that path, Raider will know of our approach, certain as sunrise. The Giant Stair might serve, said Sir Malador Locke, or the Skirling Pass, if it's clear. The wine was steaming. John lifted the kettle off the fire, filled 8 cups, and carried them into the tent. The old bear was peering at the crude map Sam had drawn him that night back at Craster's Keep. He took a cup from John's tray, tried a swallow of the wine, and gave a brusque nod of approval. His raven hopped down his arm. Corn, it said. Corn! Corn! Sir Otin Withers waved the wine away.
I would not go into the mountains at all, he said in a thin, tired voice. The Frostfangs have a cool bite, even in summer. And now, if we should be caught by a storm...
I do not mean to risk the Frostfangs unless I must, said Mont. Wildlings can no more live on snow and stone than we can. They will emerge from the heights soon, and for a host of any size, the only route is along the Miltwater. If so, we are strongly placed here. They cannot hope to slip by us.
They may not wish to. They are thousands, and we will be 300 when the Halfhand reaches us. Sir Malador accepted a cup from John.
If it comes to battle, we could not hope for better ground than here, declared Mormont. We'll strengthen the defences. Pits and spikes, calthops scattered on the slopes, every breach mended. Jarman, I'll want your sharpest eyes as watchers, a ring of them, all around us and along the river, to warn of any approach. Hide them up in trees, and we'd best start bringing up water, too, more than we need. We'll dig cisterns. It will keep the men occupied, and may prove needful later.
My rangers, started Thorin Smallwood.
Your rangers will limit their ranging to this side of the river until the Halfhand reaches us. After that, we'll see. I will not lose more of my men.
Mance Raider might be massing his host a day's ride from here, and we'd never know,
Smallwood complained.
We know where the wildlings are massing. Mormont came back. We had it from Crestron. I mislike the man, but I do not think he'd lie to us on this.
As you say,
Smallwood took a sullen leave. The others finished their wine and followed more courteously.
Shall I bring your supper, my lord? John asked. Corn!
The raven cried. Mormont did not answer at once. When he did, he said only,
Did your wolf find game today?
He's not back yet.
We could do with fresh meat.
Mormont dug into a sack and offered his raven a handful of corn.
You think I'm wrong to keep the rangers close?
It's not for me to say, my lord.
It is, if you're asked.
If the rangers must stay in sight of the fist, I don't see how they can hope to find my uncle, John admitted.
They can't.
The raven pecked at the colonel's in the old bear's palm.
200 men or 10,000. The country is too vast.
The corn gone, Mormont turned his hand over. You would not give up the search?
Maester Aemon thinks you clever.
Mormont moved the raven to his shoulder. The bird tilted its head to one side, little eyes aglitter. The answer was there. Is it? It seemed to me that it might be easier for one man to find 200 than 200 to find one. The raven gave a cackling scream, but the old bear smiled through the gray of his beard.
This many men and horses leave a trail even Aemon could follow. On this hill, our fires ought to be visible as far off as the foothills of the Frostfangs. If Ben Stark is alive and free, he will come to us. I have no doubt.
Yes, said John, but what if...
He's dead?
Mormont asked, not unkindly. John nodded, reluctantly.
Dead,
the raven said.
Dead, dead.
He may come to us anyway, the old bear said, as Arthur did. And Jaffa Flowers. I dread that as much as you, John, but we must admit the possibility.
Dead,
the raven cawed, ruffling its wings. Its voice grew louder and more shrill.
Dead!
Mormont stroked the bird's black feathers and stifled a sudden yawn with the back of his hand.
I will forsake supper, I believe. Rest will serve me better. Wake me at first light.
Sleep well, my lord. John gathered up the empty cups and stepped outside. He heard distant laughter, the plaintive sound of pipes. A great blaze was crackling in the center of the camp, and he could smell stew cooking. The old bear might not be hungry, but John was. He drifted over toward the fire. Dywin was holding forth, spoon in hand.
I know this wood as well as any man alive, and I tell you, I wouldn't care to ride through it alone tonight. Can't you smell it?
Gren was staring at him with wide eyes. But Dolorous Ed said,
All I smell is the shit of 200 horses, eh? And their stew, which has a similar aroma, now I come to sniff it.
I've got your similar aroma right here.
Hake patted his dirk. Grumbling, he filled John's bowl from the kettle. The stew was thick with barley, carrot and onion, with here and there a ragged shred of salt beef, softened in the cooking.
What is it you smell, Dywin?
Asked Gren. The forester sucked on his spoon for a moment. He had taken out his teeth. His face was leathery and wrinkled, his hands gnarled as old roots.
Seems to me like it smells, well, cold.
Your head's as wooden as your teeth, Hake told him. There's no smell to cold.
There is, thought John, remembering the night in the Lord Commander's chambers. It smells like death. Suddenly, he was not hungry anymore. He gave his stew to Gren, who looked in need of an extra supper to warm him against the night. The wind was blowing briskly when he left. By morning, frost would cover the ground, and the tent ropes would be stiff and frozen. A few fingers of spice wine slushed in the bottom of the kettle. John fed fresh wood to the fire and put the kettle over the flames to reheat. He flexed his fingers as he waited, squeezing and spreading until the hand tingled. The first watch had taken up their stations around the perimeter of the camp. Torches flickered all along the ring wall. The night was moonless, but 1,000 stars shone overhead. A sound rose out of the darkness, faint and distant, but unmistakable, the howling of wolves. Their voices rose and fell, a chilly song and lonely. It made the hairs rise along the back of his neck. Across the fire, a pair of red eyes regarded him from the shadows. The light of the flames made them glow.
Ghost, John breathed, surprised. So you came inside after all, eh?
The white wolf often hunted all night. He had not expected to see him again till daybreak.
Was the hunting so bad? He asked. Here, to me, ghost.
The direwolf circled the fire, sniffing John, sniffing the wind, never still. It did not seem as if he were after meat right now.
When the dead came walking, ghost knew. He woke me, warned me.
Alarmed, he got to his feet. Is something out there? Ghost, do you have a scent?
Dywin said he smelled cold.
The direwolf loped off, stopped, looked back.
He wants me to follow.
Pulling up the hood of his cloak, John walked away from the tents, away from the warmth of his fire, past the lines of shaggy little garrons. One of the horses whickered nervously when Ghost padded by. John soothed him with a word and paused to stroke his muzzle. He could hear the wind whistling through cracks in the rocks as they neared the ring wall. A voice called out a challenge. John stepped into the torchlight. I need to fetch water for the Lord Commander.
Go on then,
the guard said.
Be quick about it.
Huddled beneath his black cloak, with his hood drawn up against the wind, the man never even looked to see if he had a bucket. John slipped sideways between two sharpened stakes while Ghost slid beneath them. A torch had been thrust down into a crevice, its flames flying pale orange banners when the gusts came. He snatched it up as he squeezed through the gap between the stones. Ghost went racing down the hill. John followed more slowly, the torch thrust out before him as he made his descent. The camp sounds faded behind him. The night was black, the slope steep, stony and uneven. A moment's inattention would be a sure way to break an ankle or his neck. What am I doing? He asked himself as he picked his way down. The trees stood beneath him, warriors armored in bark and leaf, deployed in their silent ranks, awaiting the command to storm the hill. Black they seemed. It was only when his torchlight brushed against them that John glimpsed a flash of green. Faintly, he heard the sound of water flowing over rocks. Ghost vanished in the underbrush. John struggled after him, listening to the call of the brook, to the leaves sighing in the wind. Branches clutched at his cloak, while overhead thick limbs twined together and shut out the stars. He found Ghost lapping from the stream. Ghost, he called, to me, now. When the direwolf raised his head, his eyes glowed red and baleful, and water streamed down from his jaws like slaver. There was something fierce and terrible about him in that instant. And then he was off, bounding past John, racing through the trees. Ghost, no, stay! He shouted, but the wolf paid no heed. The lean white shape was swallowed by the dark, and John had only two choices, to climb the hill again, alone, or to follow. He followed, angry, holding the torch out low so he could see the rocks that threatened to trip him with every step, the thick roots that seemed to grab at his feet, the holes where a man could twist an ankle. Every few feet, he called again for Ghost, but the night wind was swirling amongst the trees, and it drank the words. This is madness, he thought, as he plunged deeper into the trees. He was about to turn back when he glimpsed a flash of white off ahead and to the right, back toward the hill. He jogged after it, cursing under his breath. A quarter way around the fist, he chased the wolf before he lost him again. Finally, he stopped to catch his breath amidst the scrub, thorns, and tumbled rocks at the base of the hill. Beyond the torchlight, the dark pressed close. A soft, scrabbling noise made him turn. John moved towards the sound, stepping carefully among boulders and thorn bushes. Behind a fallen tree, he came on Ghost again. The direwolf was digging furiously, kicking up dirt. What have you found? John lowered the torch, revealing a rounded mound of soft earth. A grave, he thought. But whose? He knelt, jammed the torch into the ground beside him. The soil was loose, sandy. John pulled it out by the fistful. There were no stones, no roots. Whatever was here had been put here recently. 2 feet down, his fingers touched cloth. He had been expecting a corpse, fearing a corpse, but this was something else. He pushed against the fabric and he felt small, hard shapes beneath, unyielding. There was no smell, no sign of grave worms. Ghost backed off and sat on his haunches, watching. John brushed the loose soil away to reveal a rounded bundle, perhaps 2 feet across. He jammed his fingers down around the edges and worked it loose. When he pulled it free, whatever was inside shifted and clinked.
Treasure,
he thought. But the shapes were wrong to be coins, and the sound was wrong for metal. A length of frayed rope bound the bundle together. John unsheathed his dagger and cut it, groped for the edges of the cloth and pulled. The bundle turned, and its contents spilled out onto the ground, glittering dark and bright. He saw a dozen knives, leaf-shaped spearheads, numerous arrowheads. John picked up a dagger blade, featherlight and shiny black, hiltless. Torchlight ran along its edge, a thin orange line that spoke of razor sharpness.
Dragon glass, what the maesters call obsidian.
Had Ghost uncovered some ancient cache of the children of the forest, buried here for thousands of years? The fist of the first man was an old place, only... Beneath the dragon glass was an old war horn, made from an oryx horn and banded in bronze. John shook the dirt from inside it, and a stream of arrowheads fell out. He let them fall and pulled up a corner of the cloth the weapons had been wrapped in, rubbing it between his fingers. Good wool, thick, a double weave, damp but not rotted. It could not have been long in the ground. And it was dark. He seized a handful and pulled it close to the torch. Not dark, black. Even before John stood and shook it out, he knew what he had. The black cloak of a sworn brother of the Night's Watch. Bran. Alebelly found him in the forge, working the bellows for Micken.
Me so aren't you in the turret, me lord prince. There's been a bird from the king.
From Rob, excited, Bran did not wait for Hodor, but let Alebelly carry him up the steps. He was a big man, though not so big as Hodor, and nowhere near as strong. By the time they reached the maester's turret, he was red-faced and puffing. Rickon was there before them, and both Walder Freys as well. Maester Lewin sent Alebelly away and closed his door.
My lords, he said gravely, we have had a message from His Grace, with both good news and ill. He has won a great victory in the west, shattering a Lannister army at the place named Oxcross, and has taken several castles as well. He writes us from Ashmark, formerly the stronghold of House Marbrand. Rickon tugged at the maester's rope. Is Rob coming home? Not just yet, I fear. There are battles yet to fight.
Was it Lord Tywin he defeated? Asked Bran.
No, said the maester. Sir Stafford Lannister commanded the enemy host. He was slain in the battle.
Bran had never even heard of Sir Stafford Lannister. He found himself agreeing with Big Walder when he said, Lord Tywin is the only one who matters.
Tell Rob I want him to come home, said Rickon. He can bring his wolf home too, and mother and father.
Though he knew Lord Eddard was dead, sometimes Rickon forgot. Willfully, Bran suspected. His little brother was stubborn as only a boy of 4 can be. Bran was glad for Rob's victory, but disquieted as well. He remembered what Usher had said the day his brother had led his army out of Winterfell.
He's marching the wrong way,
the wildling woman had insisted.
Sadly, no victory is without cost. Maester Lewin turned to the Walders. My lords, your uncle, Sir Stephen Frey, was among those who lost their lives at Oxcross. He took a wound in the battle, Rob writes. It was not thought to be serious, but 3 days later, he died in his tent, asleep.
Big Walder shrugged.
He was very old, 65, I think. Too old for battles. He was always saying he was tired.
Little Walder hooted.
Tired of waiting for our grandfather to die, you mean? Does this mean Sir Eamon's the heir now?
Don't be stupid,
his cousin said.
The sons of the first son come before the second son. Sir Ryman is next in line, and then Edwin and Black Walder and Petiah Pimple, and then Aegon and all his sons.
Ryman is old too, said little Walder. Past 40, I bet, and he has a bad belly. Do you think he'll be lord?
I'll be lord. I don't care if he is.
Maester Lewin cut in sharply.
You ought to be ashamed of such talk, my lords. Where is your grief? Your uncle is dead.
Yes, said little Walder.
We're very sad.
They weren't, though. Bran got a sick feeling in his belly.
They like the taste of this dish better than I do. He asked Maester Lewin to be excused.
Very well.
The maester rang for help. Hodor must have been busy in the stables. It was Usher who came. She was stronger than Alebelly, though, and had no trouble lifting Bran in her arms and carrying him down the steps.
Usher, Bran asked as they crossed the yard, do you know the way north, to the wall and even past?
The way's easy. Look for the ice dragon and chase the blue star in the rider's eye.
She backed through a door and started up the winding steps.
And there are still giants there, and the rest, the others, and the children of the forest too?
The giants I've seen, the children I've heard tell of, and the white walkers. Why do you want to know?
Did you ever see a three-eyed crow?
No, she laughed. And I can't say I'd want to.
Usher kicked open the door to his bedchamber and set him in his window seat where he could watch the yard below. It seemed only a few heartbeats after she took her leave that the door opened again, and Jojen Reed entered unbidden, with his sister Mira behind him.
You heard about the bird? Bran asked.
The other boy nodded.
It wasn't a supper, like you said. It was a letter from Rob, and we didn't eat it, but...
The green dreams take strange shapes sometimes,
Jojen admitted.
The truth of them is not always easy to understand.
Tell me the bad thing you dreamed, Bran said. The bad thing that is coming to Winterfell.
Does my Lord Prince believe me now? Will he trust my words, no matter how queer they sound in his ears?
Bran nodded.
It is the sea that comes.
The sea?
I dreamed that the sea was lapping all round Winterfell. I saw black waves crashing against the gates and towers, and then the salt water came flowing over the walls and filled the castle. Drowned men were floating in the yard. When I first dreamed the dream, back at Greywater, I didn't know their faces, but now I do. That Alebelly is one, the guard who called our names at the feast. Your Septon's another, your Smith as well. Micken?
Bran was as confused as he was dismayed.
But the sea is hundreds and hundreds of leagues away, and Winterfell's walls are so high the water couldn't get in, even if it did come. In the dark of night, the salt sea will flow over these walls, said Jojen. I saw the dead, bloated and drowned. We have to tell them, Bran said, Alebelly and Micken and Septon Shale. Tell them not to drown. It will not save them, replied the boy in green.
Mira came to the window seat and put a hand on his shoulder.
They will not believe, Bran, no more than you did.
Jojen sat on Bran's bed.
Tell me what you dream.
He was scared even then, but he had sworn to trust them, and the Stark of Winterfell keeps his sworn word.
There's different kinds, he said slowly. There's the wolf dreams, but those aren't so bad as the others. I run and hunt and kill squirrels. And there's dreams when the crow comes and tells me to fly. Sometimes the tree is in those dreams, too, calling my name. That frightens me. But the worst dreams are when I fall.
He looked down into the yard, feeling miserable.
I never used to fall before. When I climbed, I went every place, up on the roofs and along the walls. I used to feed the crows in the burnt tower. Mother was afraid that I would fall, but I knew I never would. Only I did. And now, when I sleep, I fall all the time.
Mira gave his shoulder a squeeze.
Is that all? I guess.
Warg, said Joe John Reed. Bran looked at him, his eyes wide.
What? Warg. Shape changer. Beastlin. That is what they will call you, if they should ever hear of your wolf dreams.
The names made him afraid again.
Who will call me? Your own folk, in fear. Some will hate you if they know what you are. Some will even try to kill you.
Old Nan told scary stories of beastlings and shape-changers sometimes. In the stories, they were always evil.
I'm not like that, Bran said. I'm not. It's only dreams. The wolf dreams are no true dreams. You have your eyes closed tight when you're awake. But as you drift off, it flutters open, and your soul seeks out its other half. The power is strong in you.
I don't want it. I want to be a knight.
A knight is what you want. A warg is what you are. You can't change that, Bran. You can't deny it or push it away. You are the winged wolf, but you will never fly.
Jojen got up and walked to the window.
Unless you open your eye.
He put two fingers together and poked Bran in the forehead hard. When he raised his hand to the spot, Bran felt only the smooth, unbroken skin. There was no eye, not even a closed one.
How can I open it if it's not there? You will never find the eye with your fingers, Bran. You must search with your heart.
Jojen studied Bran's face with those strange green eyes.
Or are you afraid?
Maester Lewin said there's nothing in dreams that a man need fear.
There is,
said Jojen.
What?
The past, the future, the truth.
They left him more muddled than before. When he was alone, Bran tried to open his third eye, but he didn't know how. No matter how he wrinkled his forehead and poked it, he couldn't see any different than he'd done before. In the days that followed, he tried to warn others about what Jojen had seen, but it didn't go as he wanted. Mickon thought it was funny.
The sea, is it? Happens I always wanted to see the sea. Never got where I could go to it, though. So now it's coming to me, is it? The gods are good to take such trouble for a poor smith.
The gods will take me when they see fit,
Septon Shale said quietly.
Though I scarcely think it likely that I'll drown, Bran. I grew up on the banks of the White Knife, you know. I'm quite the strong swimmer.
Alebelly was the only one who paid the warning any heed. He went to talk to Jojen himself, and afterwards stopped bathing and refused to go near the well. Finally, he stank so bad that six of the other guards threw him into a tub of scalding water and scrubbed him raw, while he screamed that they were going to drown him like the frog boy had said. Thereafter, he scowled whenever he saw Bran or Jojen about the castle and muttered under his breath. It was a few days after Alebelly's bath that Sir Roderick returned to Winterfell with his prisoner, a fleshy young man with fat, moist lips and long hair who smelled like a privy, even worse than Alebelly had.
Reek is called,
Hayhead said when Bran asked who he was.
I never heard his true name. He served the bastard of Bolton and helped him murder Lady Ornwood, they say.
The bastard himself was dead, Bran learned that evening over supper. Sir Roderick's men had caught him on Hornwood land doing something horrible. Bran wasn't quite sure what, but it seemed to be something you did without your clothes, and shot him down with arrows as he tried to ride away.
but they came too late for poor Lady Hornwood, though. After their wedding, the bastard had locked her in a tower and neglected to feed her. Bran had heard men saying that when